This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. I use it with my patients at the Hoffman Center all the time. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, the company is offering you special savings of $50 and free shipping. To find out more, go to TryZonaNow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman to get your $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to do kind of a potpourri of stories that are hanging around in my inbox, and stories that don't make it onto our regular radio program, but that deserve attention. And the first of which is a story that broke just last week in the New York Times. It's all over the media, and it's very reminiscent of what the tobacco industry did to conceal the dangers of tobacco. You may remember the movie The Insider, starring Russell Crowe, which dramatizes the way that Big Tobacco sought to suppress the harmful effects of smoking. And, you know, this is historical fact. They did so. They even went to congressional hearings and said, well, there's not a lot of evidence. Yeah, it's junk science. We can't really establish a direct connection between smoking and heart disease and cancer. And the top executives took an oath before Congress in special testimony and basically whitewashed the potential hazards of cigarettes. Well, a similar thing is happening when it comes to the American diet and the food industry, and in particular, the sugar industry. Big story in the Times, how the sugar industry shifted blame to fat. And they actually discovered the incriminating documents, and everybody concerned is dead. So the statute of limitations, shall we say, has really expired. There's nobody left to do a perp walk. But I say here in this article, the sugar industry paid scientists in the 1960s to downplay the link between sugar and heart disease and promote saturated fat as the culprit instead. These are newly discovered documents by a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. And we have to give some credit to the Journal of the American Medical Association, a conservative medical journal, for publishing this in the face of corporate giants who might suffer embarrassment as a result of publication of these documents. These documents suggest that 5 decades of research into the role of nutrition in heart disease, including many of today's dietary recommendations, may have been largely shaped by the sugar industry. So, and it still happens, because you see studies even recently commissioned by, the soft drink industry, Coca-Cola or Pepsi. They have special health advisory councils. And what they're saying is that, sugar's not so bad. And it can be part of a healthy lifestyle. You know, drink, your Coke and Pepsi. Just make sure you exercise. The new escape hatch is to say, the reason that Americans are having so much cardiovascular disease and obesity is because we're sedentary. It's not about the amount of soda that we drink. It's soda, in moderation. They're making smaller cans now. They're making diet drinks, which we now recognize are equally harmful. Or you can spend a lot on water, exclusively bottled water with fancy labels. They don't care, because they'll get you in the end one way or another. According to Dr. Stanton Glantz, a professor of medicine at University of California at San Francisco and an author of the new paper published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, he says, quote, they were able to derail the discussion about sugar for decades. So this is, here are the particulars. They formed a trade group innocuously named the Sugar Research Foundation, which has morphed into the present-day Sugar Association. They paid three Harvard scientists the equivalent of about $50,000 in today's dollars. You know, that's Harvard scientists, they don't, their salaries aren't that great. So you can get them for about 50 grand. To publish a 1967 review of sugar, fat, and heart research. And of course, they stacked the deck. They didn't say you can come to your own independent conclusion. They say, yeah, can we kind of would like you to come to the conclusion that sugar is not the problem, but rather, cast aspersions on the role of saturated fat, which then became vilified, demonized, as the gunk that clogs your arteries, whereas sugar, no problem, right? They give a chance for the Sugar Association to respond. And in a statement responding to the JAMA report, the Sugar Association said that the 1967 review was published at a time when medical journals didn't typically require researchers to disclose funding sources or potential financial conflicts of interest. Right? So, now we have a little greater transparency. The sugar industry also retaliated. They said, most concerning is the growing use of headline baiting articles to trump, that's a bad word these days, to trump quality scientific research. So, you know, they're pushing back against the conclusions of the JAMA article. In 1965, here are some of the particulars. A top sugar industry executive, John Hixon, discussed a plan with others in the industry to shift public opinion through our research and information and legislative programs. We can just imagine the meeting, you know, in an executive suite where they said, hey, you know, we've got a bit of a public relations problem. People are worried about sugar consumption, and we've got to come up with some good PR about sugar, exonerating sugar as a health hazard. Because at the time, studies were already pointing to a relationship between high sugar diets and the country's high rates of heart disease. So these, you know, this is precisely in the era of Mad Men, you know, the TV series. And you can imagine these executives sitting around discussing how they can strategically push back against the perception, the public perception that sugar is bad for you. So sugar industry executive, Mr. Hixon, enlisted Harvard researchers to write a view that we debunk the anti-sugar studies. He paid them a total of $6,500, which doesn't seem like much, but that's the equivalent of $49,000 today. As I said, you could hire a Harvard researcher on the cheap, especially in the day. Because, hey, you know, remember, in 1964, you know, you could buy a car for, like a new car for what? $3,500. Dr. Hegsted, who is Harvard's Dr. Hegsted, reassured the sugar executives. He said, we are well aware of your particular interest, and we will cover this as well as we can. In other words, there's evidence of collusion. We kind of know what, in essence, he's saying is we kind of know where you want to go with this, quote, research or this study or this review. So we will reflect the interests of the sugar industry in our conclusions. And they didn't work independently. In fact, they periodically shared and discussed early drafts with the sugar executive. And they said, you know, they sent him the drafts. He said, what do you like this? Is this, you know, is this according to what you're interested in seeing? And the sugar executive penciled some notes and responded that he was very pleased with what they were writing. The Harvard scientists ultimately dismissed the data on sugar as weak, and they gave far more credence to the data implicating saturated fat. So the consequence of this is that this, for many years, this pushed back the revelation that sugar really is a major contributory factor to cardiovascular disease. And they say here in the Times article, the debate about sugar and heart disease died down while low-fat diets gained the endorsement of many health authorities. following the lead of these Harvard researchers and others. We don't even know how many other important researchers were also on the take, so to speak, from the various industries that are interested in broadcasting the high carb, low fat message. So very interesting, and it looks like in some ways the Times is doing sort of a mea culpa. And this is the very self-same New York Times that have for many, so many years, has been pretty happy to promulgate the low-fat diet myth. And it's taken them so many years to acknowledge. And they did to some extent by publishing a big story a few years back by Gary Taubes with a picture of a T-bone steak on the cover of the their weekend Sunday Times magazine. Entitled, Is It All a Big Fat Lie? In other words, the incrimination and demonization of fat, maybe that's not really the problem. And that's certainly Gary Taubes' message. Gary Taubes has been a frequent contributor here on Intelligent Medicine. So, of interest is that, just a few days before this revelation about the sugar industry, the Times published an article by two physicians who are involved in weight loss entitled, Before You Spend $26,000 on Weight Loss Surgery, Do This. That's pretty good clickbait. It's intriguing. I'll read on. Sarah Halberg and Osama Hamdi are physicians who are involved in a weight loss practice. Sarah Halberg is medical director of the weight loss program at the Indiana University Health Arnett, adjunct professor at the School of Medicine, director of the Nutrition Coalition. So she's got great credentials. Osama Hamdi is the medical director of the obesity and inpatient diabetes program at the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard Medical School. So, far be it from them to consult an integrative doctor like myself. We've been talking about this for years, but this concept has gone mainstream. What they're saying here is that instead of going in for risky, expensive bariatric surgery, they say when someone has diabetes, to lower glucose levels, patients get insulin shots, or a patient with diabetes can be on four or five different medications to control blood glucose with an annual price tag of thousands of dollars. Yet there's another more effective way to lower glucose levels. Eat less of it. And they say glucose is the breakdown product of carbohydrates, which are found principally in wheat, rice, corn, potatoes, fruit, and sugars. Restricting these foods keeps blood sugar low. Moreover, replacing those carbohydrates with healthy protein and fats, the most naturally satiating of foods, often eliminates hunger. People can lose weight without starving themselves or even counting calories. At our obesity clinics, they go on, we've seen hundreds of patients who, after cutting down on carbohydrates, lose weight and get off their medications. One patient in his 50s was a brick worker so impaired by diabetes that he'd retired from his job. He came to see one of us last winter, 100 pounds overweight and panicking. He'd been taking insulin prescribed by a doctor who said he would need to take it for the rest of his life. Yet even with insurance coverage, his drugs cost hundreds of dollars a month, which he knew he couldn't afford any more than he could bariatric surgery. Instead, we advised him to stop eating most of his meals out of boxes packed with processed flour and grains, replacing them with fresh meat, eggs, nuts, and even butter. Within 5 months, his blood sugar levels had normalized, and he was back to working part-time. Today, he no longer needs to take insulin. And they go on and on. They cite a trial that found that 44% of low-carb dieters were able to stop taking one or more diabetes medications after only a few months. A similar trial reported that those numbers, that 34% of patients were able to take stop taking their diabetes medications with a low-carb diet. They get solidly behind this, cite all the evidence, and we'll post this article, of course, at drhoffman.com, and we'll get the word out on Facebook and on Twitter, as we usually do. part of our intelligent medicine outreach. So pretty cool. New York Times, finally getting with the program, recognizing that our low-fat diet frenzy has mostly got us into trouble, and that low-carb dieting is the way to go. So that's the New York Times kind of doing an about-face. Moving right along, we have here an interesting story that's a follow-up to a series of articles that I wrote a couple of months ago on the subject of PPIs, proton pump inhibitors. These are powerful drugs like Prepulsid and Prevacid and Nexium, very, very popular drugs, whether it's statins or these drugs that are most popular. Best-selling drugs in the United States is perhaps a little bit of a subject of contention, but they're right up there, and literally tens of millions of Americans take them, and sometimes they're consigned to a lifetime of taking them. Doctors say, hey, you know, if it provides relief, go ahead and take these medications. They're notoriously hard to get off of. In that series of articles, we tell people about the hazards of these proton pump inhibitors and also give people a program for weaning off harmful proton pump inhibitors, because they have a lot of side effects. They can cause osteoporosis. They increase the risk of pneumonia. They increase the risk of irritable bowel syndrome and even C. difficile, a deadly form of diarrhea. And on it goes. There are a wide variety of side effects. There's some association with dementia. And certainly you can have some rip-roaring nutritional deficiencies because of malabsorption. And the latest side effect that has come to light is that the long-term use of these medications increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. And now researchers think they know why. And I have an article here from Science News. Acid reducers may harm blood vessels. Okay, this is a lab study. It's not a study in humans, but it's a study that's designed to pinpoint exactly what happens in cells when people consume proton pump inhibitors, which, of course, don't just work in the stomach. They work in the bloodstream and circulate throughout the body and literally immerse your cells in frankly, a designer molecule, something that has not been experienced by the human body in its millions of years of exquisite evolution. So what they say is that proton pump inhibitors gunk up cells, and I'm quoting, that typically line the veins and arteries like a slick coat of Teflon. This excess cellular junk ages the cells, which could make blood vessels work less smoothly. 8% of U.S. adults, they say, were taking prescription PPIs, according to a survey published last year in JAMA. Quote, these are very powerful drugs. They're not Tums. And so the researchers explored what chronic exposure to the drugs, which travel through the bloodstream, does to cells lining the blood vessels. Human cells treated with Nexium seem to age faster than untreated cells. The cells lost their youthful shape and instead, quote, looked kind of like a fried egg. They lost the ability to split into new cells and regenerate, which is another sign of aging. Specifically, the cells seem to damage cellular chambers, little organelles within the cell called lysosomes. These lysosomes are like tiny garbage disposals. They accumulate cellular debris, and they're like internal garbage bags, and then they get pushed out to the outside of the cell so that the toxins or the debris or the waste products can be excreted. But PPIs shut down acid production in the stomach. They also seem to shut down the acidic garbage disposals too. So that causes damaged proteins to pile up within the cells And this can be the basis for all sorts of problems. It could even cause platelets and white blood cells to stick to the walls of arteries, like Velcro. And that, accumulation of platelets and white blood cells can be the beginning of the accumulation of atherosclerosis. Quote, that's how hardening of the arteries starts. So again, this is what's called in vitro research, which means in the test tube. You know, often in science, they divide research into in vivo versus in vitro. So in vitro research in the test tube often suggests an effect in living organisms. The next step is to test in animals and eventually in humans. But, you know, I guess we've got a ongoing experiment here in the United States where millions and tens of millions of people are taking these medications. And maybe, just maybe, we ought to hurry up and study what happens to people after they take these medications for long periods of time. Because the test tube or in vitro evidence suggests that maybe, just maybe, this is a very, very realistic prospect in people. And okay, you know, take these acid blocking medications, perhaps for short periods of time to relieve ulcers or relieve severe gastroesophageal reflux. But consigning people to a lifetime on these medications, you may alleviate one problem, which is acid burning, or gastro, you know, GI discomfort. But you may trade it in for a host of other problems, and far more serious and dangerous problems than a little good old-fashioned heartburn, which can be alleviated with diet and natural means, outlined in a series of articles that I put up at drhoffman.com. Please find those articles, and if you're hooked on PPIs, consider using the approaches I've outlined there, either on your own or with a little bit of help from your medical nutritionist. To get off, you'll be a lot better off without those.